I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Education can be the golden ticket to success and financial mobility, but not for everyone. For a number of students in the Kansas City metropolitan area, educational inequality holds them back. Today, what contributed to this disparity and what continues to prevent us from eliminating it? We learn how the differences between suburban and urban districts are maintained and the impact of poverty on those trying to find better educational opportunities. Then, two Kansas City groups want to close the gender gap in the cyber tech industry. Learn how they're showing girls that they can be the answer to the industry's worker shortage. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The more things change, the more they stay the same. That saying certainly applies to education in the Kansas City area. Parts of the metro that have struggled with educational testing scores since the 1950s are still struggling today. And no surprise here, neighborhoods with the lowest test scores are also the parts of the metro that are the most financially challenged. They are also the parts of the metro where the most African Americans live. Now, how educational inequality in the greater Kansas City area remains an enduring problem. Our guest is John Rury. He's a professor in the KU Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies. He wrote a report on educational inequality in the Kansas City area for the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. John, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
The title of this report is Educational Inequality in Greater Kansas City Remains an Enduring Problem. And I'm wondering, how so?
Well, as the report outlines, there's a tremendous inequality, particularly between the suburban school districts and the two central urban districts, that is Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools and Kansas City, Kansas Public Schools.
Mm-hmm. The historic Brown versus Board of Education ruling, though, came down from the Supreme Court in 1954. It outlawed separate but equal schools. Are you saying we've barely progressed since then, Professor?
Well, many things have changed, actually. In 1954, there were about almost 90 school districts in metropolitan Kansas City. Today, we have less than 30. So most of that consolidation occurred in the suburbs. And it's the rise of those larger, more affluent suburban districts that really changed the educational landscape in the time since Brown.
But you're saying that the inner city school districts, in terms of their progress, you're not seeing a whole lot.
Well, it's interesting. In 1954, the Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools were the leading school district in the area. It had the largest schools. At Southwest High was hands down the very best school in the area. And in 1957, both Time and Newsweek magazine ran an article the same week listing what they described as the 38 best high schools in the country. And Southwest was near the top of that list. So what happened was two things. Number one, people moving out of the city for a variety of reasons to these suburban communities. And when I say suburban, Kansas City is a little bit unusual in the sense that it underwent this process of annexation whereby it expanded geographically. That was the brainchild of Perry Cookingham, who was this sort of visionary city manager at the late 1950s and early 1960s. But when the city expanded, it didn't change the school district lines. So many of the so-called suburban school districts were actually within the city itself. So people moved out to these districts because it was new areas of the city. It was new housing. People could have lawns. They could have more closet space. Families were growing. But they were also concerned about schools. And the other thing that happened at this time was the migration of African Americans from the South, largely because the economy of the South was changing. The cotton industry was mechanizing. So African Americans moved out of the countryside and into the cities, and many moved north. So between 1950 and 1970, the African American population of both Kansas City, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri, more than doubled.
Mm-hmm. So what happened to the quality of the Kansas City schools then over time? What happened?
Well, it's as middle-class white students moved out and very impoverished African Americans moved in, that created challenges for the schools. So the overall perception of the quality of schools went down. But it is interesting. For African Americans coming from the South, these were actually better schools than they'd had there. So African American graduation rates and performance and achievement measures went up, but it didn't go up as to meet the what had existed prior to that. So improving conditions for African Americans, but declining conditions or perceptions of conditions in general is sort of the big story.
And that leads to the title of your report, Educational Inequality in Greater Kansas City Remains an Enduring Problem. You're not seeing the progress in the cities that maybe we should be expecting.
No, the big issue is what I call in the report and in the book that I've written about this, concentrated disadvantage or highly racialized poverty. And so the central city area that serves the Kansas City, Missouri public schools, if you look at those census tracts in the historically African-American neighborhoods, the levels of poverty there have remained in the 30, and many of those tracts have remained in the 30 to 40% level, which is much higher than anywhere else in the metropolitan area. And this brings a whole host of issues that makes it very difficult for schools to function effectively.
Your point being that the correlation between poverty and poor performance in school remains pretty strong.
Yes.
And your report talks about that.
Yes, that's the most important factor. This leads to and it impacts particularly impact on the typical households in these areas. The lack of employment leads to marriages becoming unstable, which contributes to the rise of single-parent households. Lots of mobility, people moving from one residence to another because of difficulty paying the rent or other issues. Matthew Desmond, in his book Evicted, which won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. It's about Milwaukee, but in that book, he cites Jackson County as one of the leading areas in the country in terms of this problem of high mobility due to this kind of instability in income. And, of course, that wreaks havoc on the schools in terms of kids moving in and out of buildings.
This notion of concentrated poverty that you just brought up a couple of minutes ago, why does concentrated poverty remain so prevalent in Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, for that matter?
Well, it's a problem across the country. It's especially bad in Kansas City in many respects because it's basically racialized poverty, and it has to do with racial discrimination in the housing market and in employment. So African Americans historically have had a lot of difficulty in moving out of these areas and finding new places to live, and we can talk about the historical reasons behind that, much of which has to do with the real estate industry and the historic effect in Kansas City of figures like J.C. Nichols and so on, but the consequence is that African Americans are still highly segregated in residential terms, and this contributes to this highly racialized, concentrated poverty.
Professor, I was going to ask you about that because I think of concentrating African-American families in certain neighborhoods as being part of our distant past. But your report says in the first paragraph that suburban districts, many still located within the city's boundaries, excluded black families interested in better schools through a variety of measures. That still continues today, and I'm wondering, like what?
I think there's less evidence of it today. In the past, Some places, I think Raytown in my book, I spent a great deal of time discussing that as an example of very active exclusion. In other parts of the metropolitan area, the exclusion was more subtle. You know, in 1964, an African-American couple moved into Westwood. This is documented in the Kansas City Star. And they bought it directly from – they bought their new home directly from the owner. As they were moving in, they were approached by three men who offered to pay them double what they had paid for the house to buy it back.
This is Westwood on the Kansas side or the Missouri side?
On the Kansas side.
Yeah.
And that was the neighborhood association. And that was one of the key points that J.C. Nichols and other developers emphasized in building their suburban communities was to have neighborhood associations that would enforce standards and also enforce the restrictive covenants even after they were outlawed in 1948. So,
but your report points out that still even today the number of African Americans living in former J.C. Nichols communities, still there's a paucity of African Americans in many of those areas, Prairie Village, the Brookside area south of the plaza. So clearly, do you suspect still something going on in terms of discouraging blacks from moving into those neighborhoods?
Well, you have to look to the real estate industry. Real estate agents in those parts of the city, of the metropolitan area, they understand that their livelihood depends upon their positive relationship with the local neighborhood associations, and that selling houses or showing houses to the wrong people could be very detrimental to their business.
So you think that still happens today then?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. We haven't had, at least that I'm aware of, the kind of study that was just done in Long Island where they federal government conducts tests by having people pose as buyers who are black and white with the same qualifications. And what they found there was that African Americans were less than half as likely to be shown homes in certain neighborhoods than whites with precisely the same qualifications.
And you suspect we'd find the same sort of thing here in Kansas City if that kind of test was conducted here?
I'd be shocked if it wasn't the case.
John Rury is my guest. He's a professor in the KU Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies. He's the author of a new report, Educational Inequality in Greater Kansas City Remains an Enduring Problem. You know, we've seen examples of racial tensions in suburban school districts even within recent months, and I'm thinking about Lee's Summit, where former Superintendent Dennis Carpenter tried to implement equity training and eventually resigned over the ensuing controversy. Is this an example of a district still resisting racial integration, in your view?
Lee's Summit has a long history of racial tension and problems. So I was frankly hopeful when I heard about Carpenter's being hired there and his interest in conducting this kind of sensitivity training, which actually we've done in Lawrence. I've done that course myself. So it was really unfortunate to see the kind of reaction that it provoked. But this is very much in line with what occurred decades ago in that part of the metropolitan area.
Hmm. This may sound obvious, Professor, but tell us why the effects of poverty are so detrimental to kids being able to achieve academically.
Well, parents in poverty households have many things to contend with. Just putting food on the table, paying the rent, these are the primary issues that they have to be concerned with. Most of them do not have much experience with success in the education system. Now, the contrast to that is to just go a few miles away to Johnson County or to the Northland where you have households with stable income and parents with higher levels of education who actively prepare their kids to go succeed in school. So that's the big contrast. In the inner city schools, many parents have trouble getting the kids to school. And, you know, they changed residences because of issues with landlords or inability to pay the rent or, you know, conflicts that occur. And the kids are changing schools. One of my former doctoral students was a principal in Kansas City, Missouri, and he told me that in his school, 50% of the kids changed every year, which made it extraordinarily difficult for him to have a very strong instructional focus in terms of raising achievement.
So given that, to fix public education in America's cities, do we need to remedy poverty then?
Absolutely. I think that the way to do that is to, desegregation was a grand experiment in the 60s and 70s. It became very controversial. And I think the weight of public opinion is that desegregation was somehow a failed experiment. But if you actually look at the data, it experienced a great deal of success. And so I think that, that the way out of this dilemma, the most straightforward way out of this dilemma, is to begin to think about something like that again.
But that would be so controversial, expending that amount of money in one district. I don't know how sustainable that might be.
Well, that's just the thing. We have to get, the 1974 Milken v. Bradley decision in Detroit, which was a 5-4 decision. Supreme Court sort of put an end to the idea of having a busing desegregation busing program across district lines, and the argument there was that this was in Detroit. The argument was that those suburban communities in metropolitan Detroit really hadn't contributed to the segregation within Detroit. Now, when the Jenkins case came up in Kansas City, the judge in that case decided not to, because it originally started in 1977 as a lawsuit by the Kansas City, Missouri School District against the suburbs, which was extraordinarily unusual. It's one of the only cases like that.
Because at that time, the Kansas City School District wanted students from the suburbs to be bused into the city to desegregate it.
Well, they wanted busing both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said earlier, most of the people who left the Kansas City, Missouri school district stayed within Kansas City, the city. They went to Raytown, they went to Center, they went to Hickman Mills. Those are the districts, and the Jenkins lawyers actually studied this. They traced where people moved in terms of transfers out of the schools, and it was to those districts. So desegregation could have been accomplished through busing across district lines, staying within municipality of Kansas City, but the judge took that off the table. He was gun shy about the Milken decision.
Yeah, but you don't sense any political support across the country for busing at that level, or am I wrong?
It varies. Mm-hmm. It varies a great deal. Jennifer Hochul, the political scientist, wrote a book in the 80s, and she had a very interesting finding that in cases where local leaders were supportive of these changes and didn't fight them, there was greater openness to it on the part of the public.
Hmm.
Kansas City's kind of a classic example of this, because the Kansas City, Missouri School Board fought desegregation actively throughout the whole process, which sent the signal to people across the city, particularly whites, that this was a bad idea, not a good idea. And that has a big impact on public opinion.
I'm visiting with John Rury, a professor in the KU Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies, about educational inequality in the Kansas City area. You talk in the report, Professor, about how Johnson County has managed to evade what you call meaningful racial integration. What is meaningful racial integration, and how did Johnson County manage to avoid it for so long?
Well, meaningful integration would be something on the order of approaching 10% of the student population. And in Johnson County, the African-American population is, less than 4%. Hmm. So there's a ways to go there. I think it's a number of things. I think it's the perception. Well, first of all, it's the real estate industry, as I just mentioned. The other thing is perception by African-Americans that this is not a welcoming place. The other thing, though, is that, you know, tax levels are high, relatively speaking, in those communities. You know, and many suburbanites this, of course, keeps people with lower income out. It makes housing less affordable. And, you know, many suburbanites will say these are sort of like membership fees, right, to be in the club, so to speak.
But what's the danger, the ongoing danger of widely disparate urban and suburban settings when it comes to educational opportunity? What's the potential threat to us?
Well, we live in a time of widening inequality. This is one of the big issues that were sort of on the political agenda. And nobody seems quite to know what to do about it. But education is our society's primary mechanism of status allocation. And if we have these inequalities that persist over generations, then we are producing winners and losers on a grand scale. And that's what we're seeing in Kansas City. You know, Richard Florida, the sort of the geographer who writes about cities, has Kansas City in his top 10 of economic inequality. And Doug Massey, you know, the sociologist who studies racial segregation, you know, again, Kansas City's in the top 20 hyper-segregated metropolitan areas. So what we see here is very symptomatic of what's occurring across the country.
And to that point, in your conclusion, you write that even if the Kansas City District regains full accreditation, and I guess it's going to be another year before we would do so, this pattern of inequality will likely endure. This, you write, and I'm quoting, remains the principal challenge facing education within the region, a problem that most of the area's leaders seem to have little interest in addressing. Why is that, do you think?
Well, people take this system that we have of fragmented metropolitan education systems. We have, like I mentioned, almost 30 districts in metropolitan Kansas City, and we have naturalized that. The idea that kids, you know, who are a few miles away from each other should have such dramatically different educational experiences could be changed relatively easily with a program of shared resources and moving kids to experiences where they get to share educational resources.
Busing, you mean?
Well, that would be one way to do it. So one thing that has been done as an experiment around the country is called Moving to Opportunity, and that's not an education program per se, but what the MTO does is to take families from impoverished inner city areas and move them to the suburbs. And
you mean physically move them where
yes,
they live?
Exactly. Move where they live. Now, that does this in a way that disperses them so they're not concentrated and segregated. And the results have been very positive. There is a transition period. You know, the older kids don't seem to do as well, but the younger kids flourish in those circumstances. And so we haven't – MTO, as far as I know, has not been tried in Kansas City, Missouri, but it's been tried.
Or even proposed in a serious way that I'm aware of.
Right. Well, MTO is a federally funded program. And it's like I said, it's kind of an experiment. They've only done maybe 10,000 families or so nationally and a select number of cities. But the results have been very promising.
That's interesting.
So something like that I think is probably the long term, the best way of doing this.
Interesting. John Rury, a professor in the KU Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies. He wrote a report for the Urban League of Greater Kansas City titled Educational Inequality in Greater Kansas City Remains an Enduring Problem. Professor, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. From President Trump and Harriet Tubman to chocolate, you'll find a little of everything in Kraske Off Mic, our weekly newsletter. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske and get it every Monday. It's quick and easy. kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, we take a trip back to Kansas City's seedier side and learn about the corruption, mischief, and booze that made the city notorious and irresistible. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. The cybersecurity industry is facing a huge worker shortage. Experts forecast that there will be up to 3.5 million job openings by 2021. Meantime, the hard truth is that women make up only 20% of the cybersecurity workforce. We still live in a society where messages get sent early in a girl's life that men are good fits for STEM jobs and women are not, and people of color are often overlooked altogether. But one Kansas City cybersecurity company and a nonprofit are attempting to put a dent in those realities. With us today, Michaela Witcher is a senior at Central High School in Kansas City who toured the facilities of the Fish Tech Group and changed her mind about her career. Michaela, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Jenny Hanna is a spokeswoman for the Fish Tech Group. And Jenny, nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve.
Cheryl Cooper is the founder of WINS, that's Women in Security. Cheryl, nice to have you as well.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
Jenny, what does Fish Tech do in layman's terms, if you would?
Fish Tech is a cybersecurity solutions provider. We help organizations make their businesses, their organizations more secure.
Your CEO, Gary Fish, is a big proponent of these tours that bring in young women to the company. He says it's exactly what every entrepreneur should be doing. Why is he so committed to it?
Well, his take on is that it is both selfish and also a community outreach. He says we need to do it to give back to the community. We need to have students through, get them excited. And then the selfish part is that we hope that within a couple years, 1 to 5 years, when they're interested in getting into the field, that they will look at Fish Tech. And if not Fish Tech, one of our other companies within the industry.
Because you're going to have jobs for them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Cooper, you're in the cyber field. What did you see that motivated you to start WINS?
Steve, the reason why I started WINS is that I work in the field of cybersecurity, and oftentimes when I went to conferences, I saw that these meetings were predominantly men. I also, through empirical evidence, saw in the workforce that they were predominantly men working in these cybersecurity roles. So I started up Women in Security Mentors Organization to encourage minorities and women to pursue careers in STEM, more specifically in cybersecurity.
And why girls? Why the emphasis there?
The emphasis on girls is because statistics show us that women only make up that 14 to 20% of the workforce. Now, some may say, well, that sounds like a good number, but what that tells us is that 80% of those jobs are being held by men. So my targeted audience are girls because women are underrepresented. We have, as you said, Steve, 3.5 million jobs globally that will need to be filled in 2021.
And you're making it a point to reach inner city kids as well. Why?
Because, Steve, once again, inner city students are underrepresented.
Michaela, I wanted to turn to you here. You took one of these tours at Fish Tech. How did it strike you? What did you make of it all?
My initial, thought of it, I didn't know, what to think of it. I was kind of, surprised by it that we actually had this in Kansas City, because usually stuff like this you'll see on the East Coast or West Coast, because we don't get as much knowledge and feedback of stuff like this. So when I first initially heard of Fish Tech, I was kind of confused on it. I didn't know what it was. So when we went to Fish Tech a few weeks ago, I was very excited. The scenery, the people there, the staff there, and then how they were explaining to how you can get the job and how they're looking forward to girls in it. Specifically, actually like the experience, because I feel like since I'm a female and especially a minority, we don't have a lot of opportunities as the other schools probably. So when they actually targeted to my district only, it actually made me feel kind of special.
Huh. You're nearing graduation, Michaela. What were your plans for after high school, before you toured FishTech's headquarters?
So before my current, what I want to be FBI forensic specialist. So that's kind of been my main thing. But I know forensic is a broad statement and a broad field. So I was kind of like thinking, like, what in forensic I want to do.
How did the tour have an impact on your thinking, you know, as you think about after life after high school? Is this something you still want to pursue then?
Yes. And actually, since I've been to FishTech and after that tour, I actually do want to go into cybersecurity, since my mom actually has, you know, showed me a couple of jobs that are opening in the FBI field, and we always go over and talk about everything. So knowing that actually technology is the future of the USA and probably the world, that's actually a good career to actually potentially go in. So I'm actually excited.
What part of the tour sparked your interest the most?
The panel. The ladies, the representatives there, everyone had their story to tell. It wasn't just, you know, it was a diversity. We had minorities. We had people who were other colors. And we actually had a big diversity of women in the representation on the board. So my favorite part is when we had the student panel and they asked, and we were allowed to ask questions about how did the women get into the workforce, how do they feel being in the workforce, and basically how did their everyday job go.
So you were seeing people who look like you speaking directly to you. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And it sort of rocked your boat a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you always had an interest in technology or even cybersecurity?
Yes.
Yeah. Some of the mentors told stories of how they came into the field. What kind of advice did they give you as you spent your time there at FishTech that day?
Just because you are a minority does not discredit you for anything. Anyone can be into cybersecurity, and just because you come from the urban background, that doesn't mean that you're not still capable to do everything else that somebody else does. And just because a man is the big number of the job, that doesn't mean anything. Like, you can still do anything a man can do.
It sounds like that was something that you really wanted to hear.
Yeah.
How did it make you feel?
It made me feel special knowing that, you know, that I'm not alone, that there's other women out there who feel the same way as I do, and there's women out here that look like me who are actually trying to, you know, reach to our community and try to get us into more opportunities, because we're not really, like, on an everyday basis, we're not exposed to things like this. We're not represented in good. So
right.
Knowing that it's people who look like me and people who don't look like me who are actually, you know, they want to actually work together and actually come to us, it makes us really special.
You know, Cheryl Cooper, again, you're the founder of WINS, Women in Security. Listening to Michaela must be, that's exactly what you're going after, I think.
Absolutely, Steve. I'm excited. As you stated, I have a doctorate degree in computer science. I work in the cybersecurity field. I'm an African-American woman. I'm a strong believer in that you have to see it to be it. And so to also expand on your question about why do I go into the inner city is predominantly African-American and Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they see me, they can see themselves.
And that's unusual for a lot of these young people. They don't have that opportunity sometimes all that often.
Absolutely, Steve.
Yeah. What happens if we don't fill all these jobs that are coming open in the cybersecurity field?
If we do not have the skill set to fill these jobs, Steve, then we will have a significant gap in our ability to protect the U.S.'s resources. From critical infrastructure to military and government activity as far as it concerns with cyber crimes and espionage.
You know, outside of seeing people who look like them, what's the appeal for these students to enter this area as a potential career? Is it the money? Is it the job security? What is it?
Steve, I would say that it's all the above. These jobs are well-paying jobs and jobs in which many of them, you don't need that four-year degree. All you need is a certification, or you need an aptitude and attitude. If you're passionate and we can teach you. We will teach you about cybersecurity. So what? That's one of the things that should be appealing. You don't need that 4-year degree for many of these jobs. They are well-paying jobs, and plus there's satisfaction in the jobs.
Hmm. You're saying that it just needs a certificate. Where do you get the certificate?
Well, there are governing bodies for certifications. One of the top certifications in the cybersecurity field is the CISSP, Certified Information System Security Professional.
How long does it take to get that certificate?
Well, Steve, that's a good question, because you need 5 years in the industry for the Big Daddy certification, the CISSP. However, there are entry-level certifications in demand, and those are being offered by CompTIA. So if you go to CompTIA.org, they have entry-level certifications that are in demand by the industry.
Hmm. Jenny, are these students coming into this already on this type of track in school? Are they on a math science sort of trajectory, or how do you see it?
At Fish Tech, we have had students that are like Michaela. They have an interest, and they're furthering it. We have had students who are in cybersecurity programs already offered, and then we have several students that come through that they don't have really any notion about it. They don't know what it is, what the possibilities are, and it opens their eyes to that.
Well, what kinds of people tend to be interested in a cybersecurity kind of career?
I think generally people who are tech-leaning,
mm-hmm.
people who understand it and understand what's at stake when you talk about cybersecurity. They are generally people that do kind of lean toward math and science. But I know that at the Girls Cybersecurity Summit, we spent a good amount of time talking about the fact that you don't have to be fantastic at math.
Mm-hmm.
Don't write it off as a possible career.
That's what a lot of people think. They think
exactly.
Computers, they think math, and they think, uh-oh.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Not necessarily. And I also wanted to point out that we do talk, when we have students through Fish Tech, we make the point that because the entire industry is growing, that there are a host of support positions within the industry that are going to be open and, you know, ready to be filled as well. Obviously, they're not the technical ones. You don't need the certifications. But, you know, marketing, accounting, admin, all of those are still positions. Sales, of course, are still positions that you need to have some level of comfort with mm-hmm. technical and cybersecurity.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about the huge number of openings in the cybersecurity field and a push on to get young girls and people of color, kids of color, involved with these kinds of careers. Jenny, what about young men? Do they get tours at the Fish Tech group as well?
They certainly do. We have a lot of school groups come through, everything from high schools all the way up to graduate students, and except for the times when we have a girls' summit, the majority of those visitors are boys.
Still, though you're pushing for girls.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Do you actually, before the tour, do you go into the schools and encourage girls to come out and take a look at your facility?
We haven't yet, but we very well may begin to do that, yep.
Is that will be an important step, Cheryl?
Oh, absolutely, Steve. And Jenny and I have been talking about what we're going to do in 2020. As you may know, March is Women's History Month. And so we're looking to do a collaboration among the security companies within the greater Kansas
yeah.
City area.
Michaela, when your friends hear that you're taking a look at cybersecurity, what kind of reaction do you get? Do they think it's cool? Do they think it's weird? What kind of response you get?
For the people who aren't exposed to it, they're kind of, you know, not much of uncomfortable, but it's new to them. And then the people who actually are interested in them, they actually love it because, you know, today's kids, all we know is technology. So to know that it's a job actually surrounding everything that we like to do, it's actually really cool.
And when your friends take a tour at Fish Tech, what kind of reaction have they had, Michaela?
After we took the tour, everyone loved it. Like, we talked about it the whole entire way back. Like, it was, like, it's mind-blowing because, you know, we live in Kansas City and you don't really see stuff like that. You see it on TV and movies. So to know that we actually have a facility that looks like that and that actually is focused on cybersecurity that we know it, and we actually got to tour it, everyone was just like, it was just crazy, mind-blowing. A lot of people are interested in STEM now, so it's kind of got our minds going.
Because they know that STEM might mean a really good job down the road, Michaela?
Yep.
Yeah. Jenny, where is Fish Tech located?
Fish Tech is in Martin City. It's 133rd in Holmes.
And these tours, do they tend to take place after school, or how does that work?
No, we do these school tours during the school day. Because we have been had so much interest, we've had to kind of say, okay, Friday is going to be our tour day. But, yeah, we usually in the mornings or the afternoon, and the students come in. We have a tour of our headquarters building, which is most of the support staff.
I was going to say, what do you show them? What's exciting for them to see? Because sometimes folks come to the public radio station, I always wonder, you know, it gets boring pretty quickly. What do they see at your place?
Well, we're pretty proud of our building. We were voted Casey's coolest office building a few years ago.
Really?
But yes.
Why is it cool?
Oh, we have a robot. We have a nap pod. Those are just the fun stuff. But we have a big open space down on the first floor.
I like that idea.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
We have an executive business center, which has an entertainment area where we do a lot of events. We have a full stage that we could produce concerts on. It's that fantastic. We have adjacent to our headquarters building, we have the Cyber Defense Center that opened this January, and that's where our Security Operations Center is held. That operates 24/7, huge big screen. It's just very, very cool.
And that screen monitors threats that are taking place around the globe. Is it that
yes.
kind of thing?
Yes.
And it's something that's pretty fun to look at.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the security analysts that are in there working, they always take time to, you know, stand up and turn around and talk to the students and tell them a little bit about their path to cyber, how they got there. And they are wildly different stories. So it's very interesting.
But what lights them up the most at your place?
Oh, I would have to say it is probably the Security Operations Center. It looks very, very cool.
Big screen, lots of blinking lights, and that's the thing. Now, Cheryl, tell us a little bit more about what a path looks like to get into this field. You're saying a high school degree, but maybe not a college degree, right?
Absolutely, Steve. And so my organization is a mentoring organization where I may come in contact with individuals entry level looking to get into the field or working with women who are already in the field looking to ascend their careers. So when I'm working with entry level people, I think that it's important first for them to understand what are the various career fields. And as Michaela was saying, and I really like that she's looking to go into forensics, because every 39 seconds, there's an attack. And so usually when there's an attack, there's digital evidence that's left. So we need forensics experts. But for those graduating students, I say go for an entry-level certification. Get a book on cybersecurity, start reading that and learning the lingo, and then get in contact with your Greater Kansas City security organizations that can support you along your career path.
Is it hard work?
Studying for the certifications, it's very hard work.
That's the real bear here.
It's very
like.
Hard work, and the certifications to take the exam can run you $800 to $900 per exam.
Mm-hmm. Does the company pay for that exam, Jenny?
I think they often do. Mm-hmm. I haven't been through that myself, but yes, I think they often do.
Yeah. How else are you reaching out to students in high schools around the metro? Because it just strikes me hearing you guys talk that other industries that need workers might want to take the same kind of path because you're having so much success here.
We do a variety of things. Several of our colleagues will go to things like speed networking at Summit Technology. I think they offer that where they just have professionals come in and the students can go around and do like speed dating. They go around and talk to the different people there. One of our DevOps Coders is going to speak at an upcoming Union Station Saturday morning STEM seminar. Mm-hmm. So we do some outreach, but we do have students come in. Another resource I wanted to mention is Kansas City STEM Alliance, because
yes,
that's an easy
we've
one
done
for,
shows with them. Yeah.
Yeah, for folks to look up, and there are resources there as well.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Jenny Hanna, spokeswoman for the Fish Tech Group, and Cheryl Cooper, who's the founder of WINS, that's Women in Security. Michaela Witcher also joined us. She's a senior at Central High School. Michaela, we're all pulling for you. We wish you all the best. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, we had a great sit-down with longtime KC sportscaster Al Wallace, hear about his 40 years in the biz and why he never wanted to cover the Super Bowl. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tune in tomorrow. We'll learn how universities are using tracking software to curate and screen their applicants. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.